ACATRA Foundation presents the ACATRA Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of ACATRA AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're taking an in-depth look at a figure whose name just echoes through history, Sir Winston Churchill.
Right.
He's often seen as the ultimate wartime leader, you know, a man of powerful speeches. But we want to go beyond the icon.
Exactly. Explore the complex individual behind the myth.
Yeah.
And we're guided here by Martin Gilbert's, well, monumental biography, Churchill, A Life.
Yeah, it's incredibly comprehensive.
And our goal, really, for this deep dive is to understand how someone who famously offered blood, toil, tears, and sweat, how he was actually forged.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to see that this extraordinary resilience and self-belief didn't just appear overnight. They were honed, really, through decades of struggle, ambition, and some truly, truly brutal failures.
So the idea is you'll walk away feeling much more informed, not just about Churchill, but maybe about what it takes to persist through difficulty.
That's the hope. Gilbert's biography is just so detailed because he had this unparalleled access to Churchill's private papers, mm-hmm. his letters, right. even testimonies.
Incredible access.
Yeah. So it's not just an epic historical account. It's actually an incredibly intimate portrait of this dynamic, often flawed, yet relentlessly driven individual. His life story is, well, it's basically a masterclass in resilience.
And the art of the comeback, perhaps?
Definitely the art of the comeback.
Okay, so let's begin. Not with triumph, as you might expect, but with his origins. Born into the grandeur of Blenheim Palace in 1874, you'd think, maybe, a pampered, idyllic childhood.
Well, Gilbert reveals quite the opposite, actually. It's a really stark contrast, isn't it?
Yeah.
Despite all that aristocratic privilege, his early life was notably starved of parental affection.
Really? How so?
Well, his father, Lord Randolph Churchill, brilliant politician, but incredibly volatile. And Winston just craved his approval almost desperately, you know. But he rarely got it. Mm. And then his mother, Jenny Jerome, a dazzling American socialite. She was often more preoccupied with her own affairs, really, than with her young son's emotional needs.
So this early emotional neglect, it must have left a mark.
Oh, absolutely. Gilbert argues it left a profound mark on him.
So who filled that emotional void? Because someone usually does.
Right. Gilbert points very clearly to his nanny, Mrs. Elizabeth Everest. He affectionately called her Womb.
Womb.
Yes. She was the one who provided that unconditional love and security his parents withheld. Her death when he was a young man was actually a devastating blow. It reveals this softer, more vulnerable side of Churchill that honestly very few people ever saw.
That makes sense.
And it's fascinating, you know, to trace how that deep-seated neglect, combined with this almost obsessive reverence he had for his ancestor, the Duke of Marlborough.
The great general.
Exactly. How that really fueled what Gilbert describes as a ferocious ambition.
Uh-huh.
It became this burning need to prove his worth, make his mark, and maybe in his own mind, vindicate his father's sort of incomplete political legacy.
And yet, his academic career didn't exactly scream future leader, did it? He was rebellious, frankly, mediocre at Harrow.
Yeah, only really good at English and history.
Right. And he failed the Sandhurst Military College entrance exam twice, which is surprising. And considering his later incredible oratory, it's quite something that he also battled a significant speech impediment, a lisp, throughout his youth.
It really is. But those early struggles, including mastering that lisp, they seem to have instilled a kind of fierce determination in him.
I think so.
Yeah, they forced him to work harder, to overcome obstacles, and maybe, ultimately, to really value the power of language, which, as you said, became absolutely central to his later success.
Okay.
And it was at Sandhurst, finally, that he seemed to find his footing. The military structure, the focus on strategy, the promise of action, it all deeply appealed to his romantic and, well, adventurous spirit.
Setting the stage for what came next.
Precisely.
So after Sandhurst, his real education wasn't in classrooms, but on the battlefields of the British Empire. He actively sought danger, didn't he?
He really did. First as a young cavalry officer, then as a war correspondent. He saw action in Cuba, on India's northwest frontier.
And famously in the Sudan.
Yes, at the Battle of Omdurman. Participated in one of the last great cavalry charges in British history. He wanted to be where the action was.
And he wrote about it all.
Constantly. His dispatches from these conflicts and his first books, they weren't just reports. They were filled with vivid, often quite opinionated prose. And they quickly started building his public profile. People began to see him as this man of action and a formidable, if maybe sometimes controversial, writer. He was crafting his own narrative, really, right from the start.
And it wasn't just writing. Gilbert recounts this truly remarkable turning point, his escape from the Boers in 1899. This seems pivotal.
Oh, absolutely pivotal. Captured during the Boer War in South Africa, his solo escape from a Pretoria POW camp. I mean, it's the stuff of legend. A perilous 300-mile journey to freedom.
And the impact.
It made him a national hero overnight. Literally. The impact was immense. It didn't just launch his political career when he got back. It cemented this public image of him as fearless, courageous, a man of action.
And for him personally.
Crucially, Gilbert suggests, it confirmed in his own mind this almost supernatural sense of destiny he seemed to possess. It was the launching pad, really. A moment where his self-belief was just profoundly validated.
So he's elected to Parliament in 1900 as a conservative. But then, just a few years later, 1904, he makes this huge move. He crosses the floor to join the Liberal Party.
Hugely controversial.
Why did he do it? He cited free trade beliefs, but many saw it as, well, opportunism.
Well, Gilbert suggests it was probably a mix, you know? His convictions on free trade were genuine. That was a key driver. But Churchill was also deeply impatient for power and influence.
Ambition again.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he felt he wasn't getting enough traction in the Conservative Party at that moment. It was a bold move, audacious even, and it certainly shaped how people viewed him for years. Risk taker.
But there's a side to him during this liberal phase that often gets forgotten, right? The social reformer.
Yes. It's fascinating. As a rising star in the liberal government, he became a genuinely progressive social reformer. He was instrumental in setting up labor exchanges, kind of the precursors to modern job centers.
And minimum wages, unemployment insurance.
Exactly. Things that sound surprisingly modern for someone with his aristocratic background. It highlights his complexity, doesn't it?
It really does. He had this concern for social welfare, believed in state intervention to alleviate poverty. Quite radical for the time, for him.
It shows a surprising empathy, maybe, and a practical drive for change. A very different picture from the later wartime leader image.
So his career is on the rise. He becomes first Lord of the Admiralty in 1911. This is the peak of his first ascent, right?
Absolutely. He's head of the Royal Navy. He champions naval aviation, which was very forward-thinking. He modernizes the fleet, crucially switching ships from coal power to oil.
Making sure the Navy was ready for World War I.
He was ensuring it was ready. He was, you could say, on top of the world politically.
But then, the fall.
Then came his most devastating failure, the Dardanelles campaign in 1915.
Gallipoli.
Gallipoli. Churchill was the chief political architect of this incredibly audacious, but ultimately disastrous plan to knock the Ottoman Empire out of World War I.
And the landings resulted in?
A bloody, catastrophic stalemate, hundreds of thousands of casualties on the Allied side. Just horrific losses.
And he was blamed?
He was widely blamed, forced to resign in disgrace, losing so spectacularly, being responsible for such a monumental disaster. It must have been utterly devastating.
How did Gilbert describe him processing that? Did he learn from it?
Oh, profoundly. Gilbert details how it was a real crucible for him. It humbled him, significantly tempered his youthful impetuousness, his belief he could just force things through.
And taught him the human cost.
The grave human cost of strategic miscalculation, absolutely. Yeah. And his subsequent move, his redemptive service on the Western Front, commanding a battalion in the Frenches.
He went to fight himself.
Yes. It gave him this firsthand understanding of the common soldier, forced him to develop incredible resilience in what he called the political wilderness. This huge setback was, in fact, essential preparation.
Preparation for what was still to come. So after the Dardanelles disaster, the 1930s see him politically isolated. His career looks over.
Completely in the wilderness.
But this period, his wilderness years, is when his prophetic voice really emerges, isn't it? Warning about Hitler.
It's astonishing, really. From this position of near total political isolation, he just relentlessly warned Parliament, warned the public about the dangers of Nazi Germany.
How did he know?
He often used a network of secret informants to gather intelligence. But fundamentally, he had this deep-seated belief in his own judgment, even when almost everyone else was dismissing him as a warmonger.
That takes incredible conviction.
It really does, to stand so alone.
And the impact when war finally came.
Immense. This unwavering, lonely, and ultimately correct stance gave him unassailable moral authority. It was the ultimate vindication of his judgment, his foresight. It transformed him from this fallen politician back into, well, the nation's conscience.
And then the culmination, May 10th, 1940.
The very day Hitler launched his invasion of France and the Low Countries. Churchill was summoned by the king, asked to become prime minister.
And he wrote that famous line,
I felt as if I were walking with destiny and that all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial.
Wow. An incredible moment of self-realization, his wartime leadership that followed, just defined by indomitable energy, right?
Absolutely. Soaring oratory, you think of. The Finest Hour speech in June 1940, rallying the nation. Shrewd diplomacy, forging the Grand Alliance with the U.S. and the Soviet Union.
He became the living embodiment of British defiance.
He really did. Against tyranny.
And yet, the twist. 1945, war won. Election.
Loss. In a landslide. The British public, weary of war, eager for social change, voted him out.
That must have been a profound personal blow.
Huge. Yet he didn't retreat. As leader of the opposition, he remained this towering global figure, famously warning of an Iron Curtain descending across Europe in 1946.
Effectively defining the Cold War.
Pretty much. It shows how public sentiment can shift, even for the greatest heroes. And it speaks to his resilience again.
He even came back again, didn't he? Second term as PM.
Yes, 1951 to 1955. Focused on post-war reconstruction, before eventually retiring. He died in 1965, age 90. Received a state funeral and honor, usually just for monarchs. A final testament to his place in history.
Okay, so we've traced this incredible, turbulent journey, but let's dig a bit deeper. What really motivated him? What were the core beliefs driving this complex figure?
Well, Churchill's worldview, as Gilbert presents it, was deeply rooted in this romantic, almost mystical belief in the destiny of the English-speaking peoples. And the greatness of the British Empire, of course.
And democracy.
Absolutely. He championed parliamentary democracy, individual liberty, the rule of law. These were cornerstones for him. And this belief system fueled his profound, visceral opposition to tyranny in all its forms. Prussian militarism, Bolshevism, Nazism.
He saw democracy, even with its flaws, as irreplaceable.
Completely.
And his personal motivations. We touched on ambition.
Titanic ambition, yes.
Wow.
Fueled partly by wanting to live up to the Duke of Marlborough's legacy, maybe surpass his own father's achievements, a profound sense of personal and national destiny.
And you mentioned financial necessity.
Yeah. Quite practically. He faced constant financial pressure, which drove his prolific writing over 40 books. It was a necessity that really sharpened his literary genius, no doubt about it.
His approach to adversity seems key. Gilbert emphasizes this, right? He didn't just endure failure.
No, it's more like he seemed to require it, almost as a catalyst for growth. After Gallipoli, he doesn't just retreat, he goes to the trenches.
Puts himself back in the line of fire.
Exactly.
Yeah.
During the wilderness years, political career seemingly dead, he produces some of his greatest literary works, like The World Crisis. He had this amazing ability to transform setbacks into new opportunities.
And he battled personal demons, too. The black dog of depression.
Yes. Gilbert discusses his bouts of severe depression, what Churchill called his black dog.
How did he cope? Did it affect his leadership?
Gilbert suggests his manic work ethic, his constant need for action, even his hobbies, painting, bricklaying were his primary defenses, ways to outrun the darkness, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it fueled empathy directly is hard to say, but it certainly reveals the immense personal cost of his driven nature. Maybe it contributed to his relentless push forward, because idleness for him was torture.
You get a sense of that relentless energy. Okay, beyond the grand narrative, Gilbert's book is apparently rich with the human texture of his life. Let's talk relationships, mentors.
It's interesting. He didn't really have one single guiding mentor in the traditional sense. His nanny, Mrs. Everest, provided that crucial early emotional stability.
Right.
Professionally, he learned from figures like Admiral Fisher, the naval reformer. But in a profound way, history itself was his mentor. He constantly drew lessons from the past, from historical figures, especially his ancestor, Marlborough.
And collaborators. He needed allies.
Absolutely. He had a loyal circle, Lord Beaverbrook, the newspaper baron, F.E. Smith, and crucially, his bond with FDR, President Roosevelt. That was the absolute linchpin of the Grand Alliance.
Gilbert details their relationship.
Yes, their prolific correspondence. It was a blend of strategic calculation and genuine personal warmth. You know, the famous anecdote, maybe apocryphal, about Churchill meeting Roosevelt while naked after a bath?
I've heard that one. The prime minister has nothing to conceal.
From the president of the United States. Whether it happened exactly like that or not, it illustrates the kind of intimacy and trust they built. And of course, his pragmatic, often difficult, alliance with Stalin was also critical.
And rivals. He certainly made enemies.
Oh, yes. Stanley Baldwin and Neville Chamberlain, the architects of appeasement. He viewed them with contempt initially, though showed some respect later. Their clash was fundamental, ideological.
And Clement Attlee. his labor deputy who defeated him in 45.
Right. Attlee's quiet efficiency and that election victory were perhaps the ultimate political blows from his most effective domestic rival. It showed Churchill wasn't immune to the democratic will, something he fundamentally respected, even when it went against him.
What about his personal life? His marriage to Clementine Hozier, so much of his public image was strength, but what about behind the scenes?
Gilbert portrays their marriage as a genuine partnership, though often a stormy one. Clementine was one of the very few people who could really stand up to Winston, challenge him, curb his excesses.
Like that famous letter she wrote him.
Exactly. Her 1940 letter warning him his manner was becoming too overbearing with his staff. It shows her crucial role as his most trusted and maybe most candid advisor. A vital relationship.
But his relationships with his children were more difficult.
Yes. Often fraught with sorrow, sadly. His all-consuming career just left very little room for real paternal intimacy. His son Randolph, particularly, struggled living in his father's enormous shadow.
It's important that Gilbert doesn't shy away from the flaws, the failures, the controversies. It makes him human, not just a monument.
Absolutely vital for a balanced portrait.
Yeah.
And his career was definitely littered with errors and controversies.
Can you give some examples?
Sure. There was his decision to deploy troops during the Tony Pandy riots in Wales in 1910. An industrial dispute earned him lasting hatred from many in the trade unions.
Okay.
His rather controversial presence at the Siege of Sydney Street in 1911, an armed standoff with anarchists in London. Critics called it a reckless publicity stunt.
Hmm.
Then there's his vehement opposition to Indian independence and his views on race and empire, which are, well, deeply troubling by modern standards and increasingly scrutinized today.
And the Bengal famine.
Yes. Criticisms regarding his government's insufficient action during the horrific Bengal famine of 1943 remain a serious stain. And economically, his decision as chancellor in 1925 to return Britain to the gold standard proved disastrous, causing deflation and unemployment.
That's quite a catalog of missteps and controversies, which makes his ability to recover time and again even more remarkable. How did he do it?
This really is, as you said before, a masterclass in resilience. It's a central theme in Gilbert's work. After the Dardanelles disaster, he doesn't just lick his wounds. He seeks redemption through direct military service in the trenches.
Facing danger again.
Exactly. His wilderness years didn't crush him. They transformed him from a political pariah into a prophet, giving him that moral authority later. He didn't shrink from responsibility. He learned from mistakes, maybe not always immediately, but eventually. He adapted tactics while holding on to his core strategic vision.
And that refusal to accept defeat as final.
That was key. He always seemed to view adversity not as an end, but as preparation for the next act, the future triumph.
So, looking at his overall impact, professionally, the legacy is immense. Saving Britain, the Grand Alliance, defining the Cold War, Nobel Prize for Literature.
Huge. And his cultural impact, too. The indomitable British bulldog, that global symbol of defiance, resilience, wit. His speeches are part of the language. He shaped Britain's 20th century self-image.
But as you mentioned, that legacy is now more contested.
Increasingly so, yes.
Right.
Prompting a necessary critical reevaluation of his imperialist views, his racial attitudes. Gilbert presents him as a man of his time, with all the complexities and contradictions that entails, which is crucial for understanding history, honestly.
So Gilbert paints this picture of profound contradictions. Aristocrat reformer, romantic pragmatist, public giant, private struggles. What are the universal human lessons we can take from this today?
Well, I think Gilbert distills several key lessons that really resonate. Let's try and frame three core takeaways.
Yep.
First, maybe an emotional insight. Embrace failure not just as possible, but almost as a prerequisite for significant success. Churchill's life screams resilience. Setbacks aren't the end. They're where the deepest learning happens if you let them be.
Right. Don't fear failure. Learn from it.
Exactly. Second, perhaps an intellectual insight. Cultivate a hinterland, as Churchill called it. His diverse interests, writing, painting, history, even bricklaying, weren't just hobbies. They provided solace, perspective, financial support sometimes, and mental resilience. They fueled his main efforts. Don't be one-dimensional.
That's interesting. Have broad interests.
Yeah. And third, a universal insight. Believe in your own judgment, especially when you've done the work, even if you find yourself standing alone. Churchill's stand against appeasement shows the immense power of moral courage and conviction, even in isolation. History might eventually prove you right.
So resilience through failure, breadth through interests, and courage and conviction.
That sums it up pretty well. And maybe a bonus one. It's never too late. His greatest contributions came after age 65. Perseverance pays off.
For anyone in leadership today, his life is just this incredible case study, isn't it? Crisis management, vision, communication.
Absolutely. Balancing strategy and tactics, inspiring people while being realistic, communicating with clarity and power.
In our current era, maybe one marked by division, short-term thinking, does Churchill's story offer an antidote?
I think it does. It challenges our modern obsession with appearing perfect, with never failing. It shows that greatness is often messy, it's contradictory, it's forged in adversity. That example of foresight, of sheer dogged perseverance, feels profoundly relevant for the complex long-term challenges we face now.
So maybe Churchill's life story leaves us with a fundamental question. When our own moment of testing arrives, whether it's personal or, you know, historical, will we be ready?
And his example suggests that preparation isn't just luck, it's essential. The ordinary choices we make in quieter times, how we learn from setbacks, how we build that inner resilience, that hinterland, that determine our capacity for extraordinary action when circumstances demand it. His enduring power, maybe, lies in demonstrating that potential within us.
A powerful thought to end on. To truly understand the complex man behind the enduring myth and perhaps draw even more lessons for your own life, we really encourage you to explore Martin Gilbert's definitive biography, Churchill, A Life. Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.